Welcome to Unpacking the Digital Shelf, where we explore brand manufacturing in the digital age.
Hey everyone, Peter Crosby here from the Digital Shelf Institute. When I heard that Outer, the premium outdoor furniture company, had achieved 1,000% growth, in no small part through customer-hosted sessions in their backyards during a pandemic, I knew we needed to find out the strategy behind it. Terry Lin, an industrial designer plus former Walmart.com merchandiser, and now co-founder and chief design officer at Outer, joined Lauren and me to talk nano-influencers, Shark Tank, and the ABCDEs of company culture that is creating a new global brand in outdoor furniture and an innovator in user-generated content. So Terry, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. You know, your approach at Outer for driving growth and brand power through community is so inspiring and powerful. So we really appreciate you coming on to chat about it.
Of course. Thank you for having me and allowing me to tell our story.
Yeah, let's just start with the mission of Outer. What drove you to start the company? I mean, there's, you know, a lot of outdoor furniture companies out there. So why did the world need Outer and what inspired you?
That's a really good question. It actually all started, I know the exact date and time. It was June 30th, 2017, 9:55 p.m.
Very specific.
And I know that because Jake, my co-founder and the CEO, sent me a cold LinkedIn message. And it was about one sentence. And it says, hey, I really like your background. I'm looking to do something. And he kind of described it as the Casper of outdoor furniture. It piqued my interest. So 11 minutes later, I responded, like, hey, sounds interesting. Would love to chat. And the reason I know that is that date and how it's burned in my memory is because that was my birthday. So I felt like the stars were aligned. And I'm sure for many of you, you get a lot of solicitations on LinkedIn. And if you hit it, all of a sudden, someone is trying to sell you something. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that I accepted the cold message and we started talking. And going back to your question about, like, why does the world need another outdoor furniture company? Well, I don't think it does. And when Jake and I started talking, I was like, well, tell me what you're thinking. And he started talking about some ideas about, you know, what we wanted to do. And he does have a family factory that has that does outdoor furniture manufacturing. So in terms of like the vertical alignment, it made sense. So I said, so, you know, what is it that you're thinking about? It's like, and he originally talked about just examples of things. And I think the example top of mind was at the time, Away luggage was really popular, and they had the portable batteries that you put into the luggage. It's like, well, maybe the outdoor furniture, if you think about the space, doesn't have power. So what if we did solar power? It's like, I don't know if that's what it is. If we really were to do something, we actually need to figure out what is wrong with the stuff today. And, you know, the thesis was that there's been very little innovation in outdoor furniture. Everyone just kind of copies everybody else. And I say that from like just direct knowledge of my past experience where, you know, I would design furniture and I would just look at what others are doing. I would look at inspiration and I would just design something that looked pretty, that had basically the right materials at the right price point and the right aesthetic. And that's all I focused on. And I do think a lot of companies still work that way. And I said, if we were to do something, it's because we want to solve a problem. What is the problem? I don't really know, but if we keep talking, I'm sure we'll figure it out. And that's how we started. So we said, you know, anytime we want to launch something, there's the what, the why, and the how. The what is very easy. Go look mm-hmm. at any outdoor furniture company and you can see a whole catalog of products that we could design. And then the next question that we always talk about is why? Why does the world need another thing? What is wrong with it? So I've started talking about it in terms of anytime we got new ideas, I say, what is the Seinfeld moment? And the Seinfeld moment is, I'm just going to guess that maybe you have watched it, but it's like in the beginning and the end of the TV show Seinfeld, he always has a monologue and he always starts by saying, like, have you ever noticed? Why is it that? And it's just really obvious things that happen in everyday life that are pain points. And I said, we need to figure out the Seinfeld moments of every single product that we design. And if we can figure what that is, then it's worthy of actually doing the how. So that was a big reason of why we started. We didn't want to be another outdoor furniture company. We really wanted to focus on trying to solve problems that had otherwise not been solved.
And so, Terry, as you thought about those problems, one of the things that I've seen has come out in the way in which you connect with current customers and with future customers is such a sense of community. And I was wondering, one, could you sort of describe what you've done there? But also, was that one of the problems you wanted to solve? Or was that just kind of a, all right, now we're solving these furniture problems or use problems. Now we need to figure out how to connect with the consumers who are interested in solving that problem.
Yeah. You know, I was going to say, and we're going to be editing it. One thing I forgot to mention was kind of the bigger picture of getting people to spend more time outside. And I was going to say, you know, a big motivation was I thought about like my childhood. I grew up in suburban Delaware, and on the weekends I would be out somewhere and my parents would not know where I was. And it would be entire afternoons, if not entire days. I'd come back muddy because I was playing in a creek. And I just think about how much time I spent outside versus how much time kids spend outside these days. Yeah. And it's getting shorter and shorter. And it's for many reasons, for climate change, it's for distractions with digital devices, lots of things. And a big reason of doing it is like, how do we actually design products to improve outdoor living? So I wanted to actually get that in there. Going back to your question about the way we are doing it, we call it the neighborhood showroom. And such a big piece of what we do has to do with social proof. And when we launched, we knew that to design a premium product, meaning something that's going to last more than anything else, it's going to be expensive. And when you think about like the quadrant of how people like people's trust and the price of things, there's like low risk, low cost, high risk, high cost, low risk, high cost, and then the last, which is high risk, low cost. And we realized in that quadrant, we were targeting the high risk, high cost category. And in doing so, a new company, like how does a new company come out with a premium product and expect people to believe everything that we claim? So in doing that, we said we need to actually have social proof, and we need to do it by actually having people be able to see, touch, and feel the product. Our product is very much about that. And then we realized that, well, we don't have the money to actually open up a retail store. And even opening up a retail store doesn't really serve our purpose. And it doesn't serve our purpose because while it may be able to target a very localized area, our addressable market is any homes with backyards. So one store in one location just really didn't work. So we thought, you know, it was really a lot of it had to do with we just needed to do it. We actually didn't have the money to do it. So we said, social proof is important. How can we do it? You know, we know that with the rise of Yelp and with Amazon reviews, that reviews are now used in the beginning, middle, and end of almost every purchase of anything that you do.
Yeah.
And so we said, you know, like we need to begin to seed this thing, have people use it. And even more, we realized that our product, people may question, like, well, I live in, and you can think about all the different areas of the country. I live in a hot area that is really dry with high UV sun and, you know, things break down. High UV resistance versus I live in Seattle where it's really rainy and wet. Or I live in Boston where four seasons, big winters. How do I know this product is going to survive?
I'm feeling that pain right now.
So yeah, the idea was if we can build this out effectively, now it's a bit of a test too. You know, like we can prove that the product that we've designed can withstand all of the different things that Mother Nature can throw at it. Doesn't matter what part of the country. So that was a big piece of it. And by beginning to have it all around the country, the idea was people might not trust us outer. But if we say, hey, you know, like we can tell you all the things that how we've designed it, but why don't we connect you with someone that lives either in your area or someone that has your sense of style or, you know, what we talk about spaces, places, and styles. Those are the three things that people care about. And if we're able to connect customers with people that are aligned with those three things, then it's another step for them to feel comfortable with their purchasing decision. And that's a lot of what Neighborhood Showroom is about.
And your approach makes it so human, focused on the customer and the people who are actually making the purchase, which is really exciting. And to your point about being a new company, you grew 1,000% during the pandemic. Is that accurate?
We did. Yeah, we were very, very fortunate. We definitely were on the right side of the pandemic.
That's really exciting. And then to your point about the Neighborhood Showroom, how did people start to react? Like, did it naturally take off as you started kind of seeding that and having people make reviews and talk about their style? Did you have to help promote that sense of community, or did it just take off naturally?
You know, I think as you think about like the growth of any company, like there are the early adopters that just believe in the brand. And, you know, as we talk to our customers, we wanted to incentivize them at first, right? And the incentivizing them was we would pay them for every visit. And I was going to say one more thing I forgot to mention. The Seinfeld moment of the Neighborhood Showroom was this. It was that, why is it that when you're looking at outdoor furniture, you're looking at in an indoor showroom? The indoor showroom is climate controlled. The person that's trying to sell it to you probably doesn't own it. It probably hasn't seen sun or rain or bird poop. So how do you actually know that it works? So that was our Seinfeld moment of why we wanted to do it, which is, if you're going to buy outdoor furniture, why aren't you looking at it outside?
Seinfeld would appreciate that bird poop was involved for sure. Probably would have.
No matter. Yeah. Lauren, so going back to your question, you know, we knew that we needed to incentivize at first. And, you know, in year one, as we started onboarding, like our Neighborhood Showroom host, we really wanted to start in the LA area, just because we could actually have a direct connection with them. And as we started getting applications, the really interesting thing was these people did not need the money at all. Like, you know, the thing is expensive. Yes. You know, their homes are really nice. So a lot of the questions we asked is like, well, why are you doing this? And, you know, we got a lot of answers. One was, I want to teach my kids how to be able to interact with strangers. Another one was, you know, I work from home and I don't have a whole lot of interaction with people. So it gives me an opportunity to meet like-minded people. And then, you know, another one was, this was actually a really interesting one. We have a host who lives in Tribeca. Jake and I went and visited him. He's like, hey, we would love to see your showroom. So we went to New York, and he's like, okay, we got to his hotel, his apartment building. He's like, come up to the, you know, my floor. So we did. He owned the entire floor. And he's like, do you want to see the showroom? I was like, yeah, we'd love to see it. I was like, okay, well, I have the entire roof. So he had the entire 14th floor too. So he obviously did not.
Wow.
$50. That's typically what we pay for a showing, which is about 20 minutes. So again, we asked the question, I was like, well, why are you doing this? Like, I think it's really interesting what you're doing. You know, like, I just want to be part of it. So the motivations that we realized had, like, while I'm sure some of it had to do with incentivizing, others had to do with like us doing something really interesting, us having to do something with building community. So it's just interesting to hear that the motivation wasn't necessarily what we thought it was.
It's just amazing to me that during a pandemic, people would have people over and at a rate that would push that kind of growth at your company. I just think that's an amazing, just human concept that was happening at times where people were doing everything they could to not be with people.
Yeah.
But there was something about this experience, and obviously it's outdoors, so it feels more safe than having somebody into your apartment, I guess. But I just think that's astonishing.
We have a host. Her name is Kathy R. I won't tell her last name, but I will tell her that I'm talking about it, who lives in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. And she became a host and just had a lot of great conversations with her. We shared pictures of our kids, her pets, her backyard. And she wanted to do a showing during the pandemic. And she really wanted to do it. So she says, you know what, for the people that wanted to see it, they're about 30 minutes away. I will sit inside my house and have my window open. They came over, they sat, they chatted, And then after it was done, the customers bought and they sent a note to Kathy, who sent it to me and said, "We really loved hanging out with you. We would love to actually get together with you when the pandemic is over." So she shared that with me and said, "Next time you get together, your whatever you do is on Outer."
And have we figured out when the pandemic is over? Because I'm not really clear. Oh, man. But moving on from that, that's a whole different podcast. Do you feel
it's like... It's really excited here. Yeah. I just wanted to say one thing. Yeah, I think it's really exciting to see that people naturally want to have a community. I think that's brought out so much more with the pandemic. And the concept of community with brands and with products and with the kind of consumer is such an important and I think valuable lesson that you have really proven out, where people want to talk to other people who are in the same boat. They want to talk to people who own the product, who are experiencing that themselves. And I love that community is becoming a forefront of a lot of conversations, because I think, like Terry, you have proven it is kind of the future of how we're talking about our products and selling our products, and it brings back that human element, which is just absolutely so impactful.
Yeah, and there's a concept that I've been talking about a lot in terms of like who we are as a company. And when you get a chance, look up the Hermann Grid, H-E-R-M-A-N-N. And it's someone from the 1800s that discovered an optical illusion. And it basically is like a grid, black and white grid. And when you look at it, what you see are you visually, it's actually not there, but you see these little gray circles between the grids. So there's these little connections that you see that your eye just makes. And I realized that, you know, so much of what we do is about that. It's not about the product. It's about those interconnections that you make. And when I talk about Outer, like, that's what it is. Like, yes, you know, we sell outdoor furniture, you know, we really are moving towards outdoor living. And it's really not about the product itself. It's about the experiences that you enable and those memories that you make. And it's like that Hermann grid that really kind of captures it for me.
First of all, I, of course, looked it up while you were talking, because I can't stand to not know about something. And it really is crazy. And the connection dots kind of make my eyes bug out. Like, it's sort of it's a really crazy illusion.
Yeah.
But those connections are super clear. And I just wondered, Terry, you know, if you were to step away from your sole focus on Outer and think, wow, this sort of community-based selling could work for so many categories. Like, if you were to consult on that, mm-hmm. you know, once you're done with Outer and it's, you know, this amazing global success, what would you think are the essential required elements that need to be in place for something like this to work for a brand? Does it almost need to be a premium thing, or is it, you know what I mean? Like, what are those things that need to, you think would be necessary?
You know, I think that, I don't think we would have been where we were unless we had, there's social proof. Of course, there is social media, and there's the rise of the sharing economy. And, Airbnb and Uber and Lyft, would you have gotten into someone's car, a stranger's car, and driven wherever you were, or stayed on someone's couch?
Yeah. Right?
You just wouldn't. And,
no.
You know, like those, the sharing economy companies have really like done a lot to build trust in that. So, I think that was really like we had a foundation that was already built, where it was not like we were trying to build trust around that. And I think, you know, like for our category, it's a little easier, because at least what I've just mentioned, other than Airbnb, where, you know, you are getting someone to come into your home, for our category, for the most part, people have side gates. And you don't actually have to go through the home.
Yeah.
And, you know, versus if you were trying to do some social proof with a mattress company and have them lay on your bed, that probably wouldn't work.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, as we continue to progress with the importance of UGC and social proof, that it's going to be able to go into basically all categories. And what I think is in the future, where we have, you have your micro influencers and macro influencers. So, you know, like that's usually defined by how many followers they have. I've been calling it nano influencers, which is maybe it's an influencer that is part of your community that knows something very, very, very specific. And, you know, just that idea of, you know, experts is important. And it goes all the way from like an influencer of 10 to influencers of millions. So I just think, you know, there's huge opportunity to do that where there are experts across the board in every single field that will continue to drive that. And in doing so, you know, it doesn't matter how they're able to do it, whether it's in person, online, whatever it is. I just think that is going to be a big part of kind of the shopping journey.
Have you thought at all about, do you find some of those amazing nano influencers? And then are you finding ways or any desire even to turn them into micro influencers or macro influencers? Like, are you finding sort of golden nuggets that are just like human beings that are so passionate that you want to put them to more work?
We haven't done that, but you know, it really just comes down to like their ambition to do something like that. And like, I'll give you an example. Like, you know, I think of influencers as the ones that are not always there to promote a something where a brand pays them. And I'll give you an example. And it's an example that I used in my past. So, you know, like I have young kids and, you know, like when you think about young kids, like there's always something that is happening and you're trying to figure out. So like the idea of teething, you know, with teething, you're going to use some sort of soothing gel or you get like these things that you freeze in the refrigerator. But, you know, like when I think of an influencer, it is not like I'm going to promote the thing that I believe in. But two, that someone pays me for. But three, I think the part is, well, I want to know some DIY tricks that really don't cost anything. So in the example that I'm giving of like, my kid is teething, what do I do? When you think of a shelf, a digital shelf, usually it's like, I am looking for soothing gels or teething gels. But really what the customer is looking for is a solution. And that is just one element of a solution. So on that shelf, and using this as an example, it could be that you dip a burp cloth, a cold burp cloth that you put in the freezer in pickle juice and have the kids suck on it. And that is an example of like what I think of as like successful influencers, where it's not always about the one thing they're trying to promote, but really about like the right things. Like I'm trying to show you that, you know, while I'm motivated by many things, I'm motivated by showing you the right things, the best solutions.
Yeah, that authenticity, you can't fake it. I mean, that's really, and you can smell the inauthenticity a mile away.
That's right.
Or closer. Yeah, that's fascinating.
And it comes back to people wanting to talk to other people who have been through it, right? Like, I don't have children myself, but if I did, I would want to ask another parent who was like, you've been through it, tell me the tricks, so I don't have to go search for them online and take hours to do it. So it comes back to that human element, which is just so exciting to see.
That's right.
And now, so in September, you scored $50 million in Series B funding after receiving $10.5 million in Series A funding in January. So first, that's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And second, how have you prioritized using that to invest in growth and to the maturity of the company and just the overall mission?
Yeah, basically, when we were doing our Series B roadshow and talking to investors, that's always a question that investors will ask, like, what are you going to do with all this money? And if you don't have an answer, then there's not a whole lot of reason to give it to you. But we were really clear what we wanted to do. You know, one, we cared a lot about brand, channel, and market expansion. So, you know, like, I think we're starting to get there when people think Outer. Like, I know when I get intel from our competition, like, oh, okay, we have to watch what Outer's doing. So you know, brand, a channel, like going to new channels, you know, we're thinking about, you know, other ways of doing IRL, you know, and when I say market expansion, you know, we are starting to, you know, expand beyond the borders of the US. We launched into Australia. And, you know, a big reason of that is, like I call it, we're chasing the sun. So like their dynamics are that our winter is their summer and vice versa here. So that's one, we care about the expansion. Two, really is about like continuing to build our team. And then three, I'm most excited about, just because it's my world, is R&D and continuing to accelerate our products and like trying to go a lot more deep into material science of what we do.
Yeah, Terry, I had seen, you know, in when I looked at your background, you spent 5 years at Walmart e-commerce.
Yep.
And merchandising, consumables, and health, fitness, and outdoors. I was wondering, what of that experience do you bring to what you're working on at Allure?
Yeah.
Yes. and what experience do you leave behind?
Yeah. You know, when I think about my career, you know, like I think the times of growth are the ones where you suck at something.
Yeah.
And I you know, it's fair to say that I sucked. At least I know, like, I sucked for the first few years at trying to figure out the merchandising side of things. And really, I had to reprogram my brain, which is heavily right-brained, because I'm an industrial designer, to, you know, a company like Walmart Ecom, where it's very much about, you know, data-driven decisions. So I had to reprogram my brain and not be like, hey, I have a great idea, we should do this. Like, well, wait, show us. Why? So, you know, a lot of my experience at Walmart was really about that, where, you know, we are a company where all of our sales today happen for the most part online. So just understanding the mechanics of, you know, e-commerce and understanding like the shopping journey, understanding how to make the experience better, thinking about all the ways, the entry points of how a customer comes in, looking at the growth. So I think Walmart helped me kind of build that muscle, which I honestly did not have at all. So a lot of that has kind of helped build out my thinking. And of course, I'm not doing it. We just have a really talented team that is able to execute on it. And I'm just good at asking questions more than anything these days.
Well, that's so much a part of a test and learn, pivot quickly, you know, be able to take in just enough data to guide a decision, but not too much data where you're always sitting around waiting for data. Like I would imagine at the pace that you are trying to grow and also as innovative as you are, a lot of it, you have to sort of test the wind and then move, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So when you're looking for talent to build a company like that, one, everyone we talk to these days is just talking about how difficult it is to sort of attract and retain talent. But also, like, what is that personality type that is required to sort of be in the stage that you're in?
Yeah. You know, I'm going to try to, hopefully I mashed this up too bad. It's something that Jake came up with, and it's the ABCDE when we talk about our team. A is ambitious. So when we interview, we are looking for the ABCDE. A is ambitious. B, which is, I think, the most important thing, is benevolent. Mm-hmm. C is curious. D is driven. And E is ego-free. And when we're talking to people, we are always looking for the ABCDE of these people. And I'd like to think that the thing that like we prioritize most is like the benevolence. And I say that because we try to do things where we do, we're not trying to talk bad about anybody, you know, competitors or anything. We never do. And like, you know, like being able to be successful in a way where you're not trying to cut people down is such a big part of it. And, you know, when I think of our people, that benevolence is probably the driving thing that we care the most about.
I love that. And I think for so many people today in the great resignation or whatever we're calling it these days, that sense of purpose, well expressed and then proven out in a daily experience, that's an attraction, I would imagine, for people that really care about how they're going to spend their day.
That's right.
That's very cool. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Of course. I was going to say, you know, like every month I do like basically a new hire and talk about Outer. And it has not changed since we started. And I always say, like, when I make decisions, you know, for Outer, why we started Outer, it's not necessarily like the main driving thing is I look through things through the eyes of my children. I have a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old. And it's like, if they are looking at me, are they going to think I'm doing the right thing or the wrong thing? And I need to make sure that, you know, I train them to make better decisions, you know? So when they are, you know, at the age where they are the caretakers of our planet, that they see that the decisions I made, hopefully they were good, but at least it was based on the data that I had, that they were the best that I could make. And when I talk to the team, it's about that. It's like, think about if you have kids or kids, what kind of life, what kind of world do you want to leave for them? And that's what we want. We want to make better decisions where, you know, it might be not moving the ball further down the field, but we are moving in the right direction rather than the wrong direction.
If I wish the whole world would adopt that approach, because it's very clarifying when you think about it in that way.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether you get this question at your at your new hire meetings. People may think it's not the right question to ask, but all right. You guys went on Shark Tank. So I have to know that, I have to hear about that experience. That was 2019, you and Jake run.
Yeah.
So most importantly, do the sharks actually like each other and talk to each other during the breaks, or are they just done, walk away? Like, what is that experience like? And and as sort of, why did you decide to use that route? And how is it, does it continue to influence anything you're doing, or was it just a sort of a moment in time for you guys?
Yeah, let me see. I'll try to break that down to each of your questions.
thank you.
I'll start with why we decided to do it. There are three ways that you get on Shark Tank. One, you apply online. Two, you go to these casting calls. And then three, the producers reach out to you. It was actually not on our roadmap at all. And anyone that has ever looked for outdoor furniture, if you search anything outdoor furniture, you will quickly find out on social media that we will start finding you. And I think what happened with the producers, they found us, they thought what we were doing is interesting, and they reached out like, hey, we really love what you're doing. We'd love to see if you want to apply. We debated a lot about it. And, one of the things that we were worried about was, do we want to be a as seen on TV brand, which is the biggest thing that scared us. And as we talked about it, like, you know what, we can, like, it doesn't hurt for us to go down the process, and actually was quite resource intensive. And it came down to, is like, if we make it, great. And if we don't, at least we tried. If we make it, we can always say no. And we said, you know, at the very least, it is essentially free marketing. It's like $1 million worth of marketing, because the show was on, I think, 24/7 on CNBC. So we said, you know, that alone is worth it. So we went through the exercise, and I want to say that the statistics are, in general, about 40,000 people. There are 40,000 applicants. Out of the 40,000, about 130 make it to, they get flown to LA for the, like, a long weekend, like 4 or 5 days. They go through the pitches with the producers, and then out of the 130, about 90 actually make it onto the season. So we were lucky to have gotten all the way from the 40,000 down to the 90. And we said, you know, if we got that far, it's probably worth it.
The effort that go for it. Yeah. Free marketing.
Exactly. So that was the big thing. And we said, you know, like, the one thing that we care the most about is that we stick to what our ask is. And if you do any research, you'll see that oftentimes the deals are not very good. They're actually quite bad. And it's because you're on TV and you want to make a deal because you want to make a deal with a shark. Right. We stuck to our guns and we said exactly what we wanted to ask for in terms of equity in exchange for whatever we were asking for. We stuck with that, which is great. The sharks, we actually did not get to meet the sharks until we walked onto the set.
Wow.
And the crazy thing is, we didn't see them. We got to do a preview. They basically said, we had about 10 minutes. They showed us the set. And, in that 10 minutes, like, you have to walk. There are going to be cameras everywhere. Make sure that you don't have any jumpy movements, because you're going to see, like, the booms and things moving around, and you don't want to be surprised, because that does not look good for TV. And then you have to land on a spot on the rug, but don't look at it. And that was basically, like, cue that we have. And then at that point, you do your 2-minute pitch. But yeah, we didn't see the sharks until we actually pitched. And then, you know, I think most pitches last about 45 minutes to an hour. And that's where we actually got to see their interactions. I do think they're friends. I think they have a lot of fun on the show. I think, you know, in anything interesting, it's about the creative tension, right? Like, who wants to be able to watch something where people don't agree with, they agree on everything. And there's a lot of tension in there about, like, you can see like a shark be like, that is a bad decision. I am not going to do that. Or, you know, like you think about someone like Damon, who, he is always about the underdog. And he was not like into us because we raised like, you know, money. I do think they get along. I think that creative tension really helps them all grow, and it makes for interesting TV where you can see there's disagreement. They laugh. They kind of like steal each other's ideas. It was a really interesting experience. I remember like usually you think about the mental prep that you have, especially for the thing where you go on national TV. Yeah. The mental prep that that Jake and I had was as we were getting ready in the ready room, like you have 30 seconds and you're going to walk out. And that's all the prep that we had. And we just said walk out, and then we did it. And I remember afterwards, Lori's husband came into our trailer, and he started showing pictures of like what happened as a recap for us. He took pictures while we were doing it. And I said to him, I was like, wow, did the sharks check out the stuff before we went in? He's like, no, Terry, that was during your presentation. And I forgot it completely.
Wow. That's hilarious.
It was like so tunnel vision that I don't even remember what happened, because I was like thinking about all the things that we had to remember. And so basically it's like taking an SAT test where you have to know 100% of the stuff, but they're probably going to only ask you like 10%, but you have to be prepared for anything they ask you.
Oh my God. I'm getting anxious just listening to you.
Same here.
Well, Terry, from the ridiculous to the sublime, back to the sublime, what you guys are creating at Outer, that idea of community-based marketing and the humanity of it. I think the world of it and then the culture that you bring to it. So I just want to thank you so much for talking about kind of this new wave of being a company and how it shows up in the world. I think it's really exciting. I can't wait to see where you go next.
Thank you. Thank you. It feels natural. It feels like, you know, when we started, like, well, this is the way it should be. You know, we always say, you know, be the leaders that you wish you had. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. That culture. And particularly I would imagine with products that are so connected to people's lives, that really matters. That really is a distinction that I think people are willing to pay for. And it certainly seems to be proving out that way. So congratulations. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks to Terry for joining us. In case you're searching for their site, you can find it at liveouter.com. Please be a nano influencer yourself and share this episode with your colleagues. And thanks as always for being part of our community.